Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from Katie Weaver and Brian Lynn. Later, we will present our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, when a child feels sick, one of the first things a parent does is reach for a thermometer. That common reaction got one man thinking. Inder Singh is a health policy expert. He wondered, what if the thermometer, in addition to measuring body temperature, could serve as a communications device? Could it then connect people with information about infections and gather real-time data on diseases as they spread? That is the idea behind Singh's health data business. The San Francisco-based company, called Kinsa, sells smart thermometers. Many people in the United States are sick with influenza this winter. In fact, this is reported to be the country's worst flu season in 15 years. Over the past several weeks, Kinsa has been following the spread and severity of flu-like symptoms across the country. The company says its findings are similar to those reported by the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. Singh told VOA that the CDC collects information about the spread of the flu from state and regional reports. But he adds, Kinsa is able to identify high rates of infection in even smaller areas or by cities. Fast and detailed information about how disease is spreading can make a difference during a health crisis. Singh said, if you knew when and where a disease was starting, you could target the people who needed the treatment and potentially prevent pandemics and epidemics from occurring. A Kinsa thermometer sells for anywhere between $14.99 and $49.99 in the U.S. Users connect the device through Bluetooth wireless technology to a smartphone app. The software program asks questions about a person's condition. The user's personal information is kept private, the company said. With its thermometers in 500,000 homes nationwide, Kinsa says it receives 25,000 temperature readings every day. The company cannot identify diseases or recognize differences between different kinds of diseases. But from gathering data about individuals' body temperatures and other information, Kinsa can report where flu-like symptoms are rising. In recent weeks, it found the flu has infected many people in two states, Missouri and Kansas. In addition to selling thermometers and advertising on its app, Kinsa makes money by selling data to businesses. Singh says that his company removes any personally identifiable information. The buyers, such as drug companies, want to know where and how sickness is spreading. They fill stores with products and change marketing plans if they know how a sickness is progressing. Kinsa has launched a program in schools where it gives away thermometers so parents can learn about the general health of the community. The company is also starting an effort with some U.S. businesses which buy the smart thermometers for their employees. When an employee has a high temperature, Kinsa can inform the person about available healthcare assistance. Currently, Kinsa thermometers are sold just in the United States, but the company plans to sell them overseas. Imagine a living, breathing map where you can see where and when disease is spreading, Singh said. That's what we want.
Writer, actor, and activist Eve Ensler has spent her adult life working to support women and women's causes around the world. For years, Ensler has visited war zones, areas of extreme violence. In 2007, she was invited to the Democratic Republic of Congo. She developed an especially close connection with victims of rape and torture there.
I think what really struck me about the Congo was the kind of synergistic cauldron of colonialism, capitalism, racism, insane misogyny. You know, all of those violences kind of being enacted on the bodies of women.
She worked with Congolese activists to create a women's leadership community for survivors of gender violence. The shelter, called City of Joy, opened in Bukavu in 2011.
And it's almost impossible building something in the middle of a war zone. You don't have roads, you don't have electricity, you don't have... It was madness.
Then her own life was upset with frightening news. Doctors discovered she had uterine cancer.
The alchemy of it all was just, you know, change or die.
Ensler turned months of difficult treatment and years of painful memories into a book called In the Body of the World, a memoir of cancer and connection. Tony Award-winning director Diane Paulus read the book and wanted to make it a one-woman show.
I thought it was some of her best writing because it was signature Eve, philosophy, politics, feminism, all told through humor and her point of view, which she does not shy away from. But it was so deeply personal.
So the director met with Ensler, and they soon began an intense process to make a play from the book. In the Body of the World moves between Ensler's fight with cancer, her painful family history, and her connection to women and nature in the outside world. Ensler says her own experiences with rape and abuse caused her to mentally disconnect from her body. The show, which recently opened in New York City, has received critical praise. I'm Katie Weaver.
As the world's top athletes competed at the Pyeongchang Winter Olympics, some robots also showed off their winter sports skills. A ski race involving robots was held recently at the Welly Hilly Park ski area near Pyeongchang. 8 teams built and programmed the robots to compete in the Ski Robot Challenge for a chance to win a $10,000 prize. The robots came in different shapes and sizes. The rules, however, required them to have the basic form of a human. They needed to be able to stand on 2 legs with joints similar to elbows and knees. They also had to be at least 50 centimeters tall. In addition, each robot had to have an independent power system and use the same skis and poles that people do. A Facebook page for the competition listed the robot names and described details of how they were built. Some of the racers looked very human-like, complete with winter clothes covering their mechanical bodies. Others rode down the hill with nothing covering their shiny, high-tech parts. Some racers were tall, others short. Some did not have heads. The robots, equipped with cameras and sensors, used artificial intelligence, or AI, to move through the Olympic-style race course. The winner was the robot that made it down the hill fastest, with the lowest number of crashes or collisions with course obstacles. Winning that top honor was the Taekwon V robot, built by South Korean robotics company Mini Robot. Taekwon V, named after a South Korean film character, skied around 5 obstacles before finishing the course in 18 seconds. On the day of the competition, high winds forced some of the Olympic skiing events to be delayed. One member of the winning team, Lee Seok-min, said he was sorry to hear about the Olympic weather problems, but he added, "The robots are doing fine here." Videos of the robotic race clearly showed some of the robots having trouble staying up on the skis and navigating the course. But several watchers of the event said they found the race an interesting way to show off some of the latest human-like robots. "I'm amazed that the robots recognize the flags as they can ski down while avoiding them," 12-year-old Son Ki-rong told Reuters. The organizer of the race, Kim Dong-uk, said he hopes the event will be the start of something much bigger. "I think in the future, robots will have their own winter games on the sidelines of the Olympics held by humans," he said. He added that until then, he will keep holding international events to show off South Korea's robotic technology to the world. South Korea is one of several Asian nations heavily investing in robotics, AI, and machine learning technology. Major developers include electronics giants Samsung and LG. Japan and Singapore also have growing robotics industries. But Asia's largest robotics developer by far is China, which set a goal to become the world leader over the next decade. The goal is part of the government's Made in China 2025 plan, which seeks to change many industries with the use of technology. One of the country's most active AI developers is Chinese online seller Alibaba. The company recently announced an AI-powered learning tool it developed performed better than human beings in a high-level test of reading comprehension. I'm Brian Lin.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. As we reported in our last program, slavery supporters failed to push through Congress a bill to make Kansas a slave state. Congress instead let the people of Kansas vote on the statehood constitution, written by pro-slavery men. The people rejected the Constitution, and slavery supporters gave up the fight for Kansas. Here are Steve Ember and Bob Doty to continue the story.
The problem of slavery continued to divide the North and South. Northerners warned that slavery could spread no farther. Southerners threatened to leave the Union unless Southern rights were protected. In the far West, one could forget this bitter dispute. There were no slaves in the West. The land and the weather were not right for the kind of farming that used slaves.
The West was growing quickly. Gold had brought thousands of settlers to California 10 years earlier. New discoveries of gold and silver now were leading men to Colorado, Arizona, and Nevada. "Don't go," warned the New York Tribune, "if you have a job or a farm. But if you have neither," it said, "and can get $50, then go to Colorado." There were many men without jobs or farms in the summer of 1858. The country had suffered a serious economic depression the year before, and jobs were difficult to find. Thousands left cities in the East. The first ones to reach Colorado reported that gold was easy to find. They said any man who worked hard could find $5 to $10 worth of gold a day, and sometimes even more.
The thousands who rushed to Colorado soon found that there was not as much gold as expected. The valuable metal became harder to find. No longer could it be washed from the bottoms of mountain streams. Men had to dig into the mountains of rock to get it. Huge digging machines and crushers were needed to get the gold from the rock. These machines were expensive. Few men had enough money to buy them. Some of the miners organized companies. They borrowed money from Eastern banks or sold shares of their companies. In a few years, almost all of the gold from Colorado came from the mining companies.
Many of those who went west to search for gold stayed to become farmers or storekeepers. Others moved farther west to find gold in Nevada or California. Some cleared the ground of trees and cut them into wood for houses. Such timber from the forests of Oregon and Washington was sold in California and Mexico, even in China and Hawaii. A few men recognized the need for transportation across the nation. Engineers planned four railroads, but northern and southern leaders could not agree on which one to build first. Until a railroad could be built, supplies were carried west in wagons, pulled by horses or oxen. Three men, Russell, Majors, and Waddell, formed a transportation company in 1855 to carry government supplies to soldiers in the West. They started with 500 wagons. 3 years later, the company had 3,500 wagons and 40,000 oxen.
Getting letters to and from the West was not easy in the 1850s. Ships brought mail to San Francisco two times a month. And once each month, mail would arrive in California after a slow trip by wagon from St. Louis, Missouri. The federal government decided to send mail overland two times a week to California. It gave the job of carrying the letters to a new company, the Overland Mail Company. The mail was carried by train or boat to St. Louis. Then it was put on Overland Company stage coaches, light wagons pulled by four or six horses. The company was told to take the mail along a 4,000-kilometer southern route through Arkansas, Texas, New Mexico, and Arizona. The mail arrived in Los Angeles 24 days after it left St. Louis.
There was a shorter way across the country, but the postal chief was a Southerner, A.V. Brown. He believed stagecoach travel might lead the way for a railroad, and he wanted a southern railroad to California. Brown said the southern route was the only one that could be kept open in all seasons. He said the other routes would be closed by snow in winter. The overland stagecoaches were large enough to carry four passengers, but not many people went to California in the coaches. The coaches never stopped for very long, only to change horses or drivers. And there were not many places to eat. Also, the trip was dangerous because of hostile Indians.
The shortest distance between Missouri and California was across the central part of the country. The Russell, Majors, and Waddell Company decided to show that this central route could be used all year. It began a speedy mail service called the Pony Express. Letters were carried by riders on fast horses. Stations with fresh horses were built about 24 kilometers apart all along the way. A rider would change horses at each station until he had traveled 120 kilometers. Then he would give his letters to another rider. In this way, the letters would be carried between California and Missouri. The first letters sent by Pony Express from California took 10 days to reach Missouri. The Pony Express lasted only 18 months. It was no longer needed after a telegraph line was completed to San Francisco.
As communications and transportation improved, the government was able to increase its control over the West. But closer ties were not welcomed between the government and a religious group known as the Mormons. The Mormon religion was started by a young New England man named Joseph Smith. In 1823, at the age of 18, Smith claimed that an angel told him of a golden book. He said the book contained God's words to the ancient people of America. Smith said he was able to read the strange writing in this book and put it into English. He called this work the Book of Mormon.
He organized a church and made himself its leader. Many people became Mormons. They believed themselves to be a special people chosen by God. Mormons worked hard. They helped each other and shared with those in need. People who did not agree with the beliefs of the Mormons did not like them. Trouble developed between Mormons and other people. Joseph Smith was forced to move his people from New York to Ohio and then to Missouri. The Mormons seemed finally to have found a home in Illinois. They built their own town and called it Nauvoo. They governed themselves and had their own defense force. The Mormons did so well that Nauvoo became the fastest growing city in Illinois. Then some members of the group split apart because of a new message Smith claimed to have received from God. Smith said God gave permission for Mormons to have more than one wife. This was polygamy, and it was opposed by almost all people. Some of the Mormons who left the church published a newspaper criticizing Smith and the other Mormon leaders. Followers ordered by Smith destroyed the newspaper's publishing equipment. This caused non-Mormons to demonstrate and demand that Smith be punished. Smith was arrested and put in jail in Carthage, Illinois. His brother also was arrested. An angry mob attacked the jail and shot both Smith and his brother to death. The governor of Illinois ordered the Mormons to leave his state. He said only this would prevent further violence. There was no choice. They had to leave. The Mormons had a new leader, Brigham Young. Young decided to take his people west and find a new home for them. He wanted a place where they would be safe, where no one could interfere with their religion. Brigham Young told his people that he had seen their new home in a dream. He said they would search for it in the west, for a wide, beautiful valley. He said he would recognize it when he saw it.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.